Hello, welcome to the Cycling Performance Club podcast. I'm Cyrus Monk, former under 23 Australian road champion and current professional with Irish Continental Team Evo Pro Racing. Joining me are my co-hosts, Dr. Jason Boynton, PhD, and Damien Roos, the man behind Semi-Pro Cycling. This week, we'll be discussing what happens when an athlete can't complete a session. Damien's been thinking about how to plan training around fueling requirements, and Jason is going to take us on a deep dive into training to increase FTP. So, how are we going, guys?
Surviving.
I'm good. I don't know if I'm going to take us on that complete of a topic around FTP. I'm specifically going to be looking at more like the claims around specific workouts that increase FTP. So,
that's good. We'll save that one for later on, because I'm sure it'll produce some pretty in-depth discussion. So I might start us off today and go into my topic, which is there's a few different rabbit holes we could end up going down, but basically what I've been thinking about is what happens when an athlete can't hit the numbers that they are planning on hitting in a session, and what we can do as coaches in that, and what the responsibility of the athlete is. So if I provide an example to get the ball rolling, you've given a set of intervals at a prescribed zone and they've rolled out and they've completed the first of five sets okay, and then the second one they've barely got through, and then the third one about halfway through they've failed, and this is a set that was planned that they were able to complete and they haven't been able to complete it. So be interested firstly just to hear your expectations of the athlete in this scenario, what you would expect them to do and what you think would be best for them to do in this situation.
I'll let you go first, Damien.
So we're talking about someone that, just remind me again, someone that didn't hit numbers initially and then sort of started fading over a few efforts.
Yeah, so they've had, say, a set of five of whatever the prescribed interval is. So let's just, for argument's sake, say a 5x5 at their FTP. And
your favorite favorite workout, Cyrus.
Well, it's a very easy one to use in this situation for the discussion. But if they're unable to complete that, or it's the rate of perceived exertion is way higher than they would usually get for that session, what would you expect the athlete to do?
Give me a phone call after effort two.
Right.
I'm half serious. I do know of athletes and coaches that will get a call halfway through a session asking for advice. But in that type of scenario, something's got to be up. Something's got to be up with the rider if it was prescribed at a level that you know they would normally hit. For me, it would initially have to fall back on the athlete to figure out what's going on, and you'd be covering off some basics to figure out if there's things outside of cycling that have been a little bit off lately. So just covering basics like sleep, nutrition, hydration, anything like that to figure if that's the cause of what happened. But that's the initial thoughts I have about falling back on what the athlete's responsibility here is.
Yeah. And then in that scenario, what's generally, so I would say similar, we'd find with most athletes, something's going on if they can't complete a set that they're expected to complete. And that's going to come down to other variables outside of the training usually, because if the plan is a good training plan, they should be able to complete each of the sessions in it. But what I would be looking at is, would you then, if you get that call, tell them to go straight home, or are you modifying the intensity or duration of the efforts instead? Or what would be your go-to plan of attack from there?
Well, you got an answer, Jason?
I think I have a little bit different approach than you guys, so I might just sit back and listen to you guys mull it over until I jump in. That's probably, I don't know how fair that is, but, or do you just want me to kind of...
back. Okay. It really depends on what you're trying to get out of this session. In some ways, if you're just trying to have some mental toughness to get through something, to build a bit of confidence or whatever it is, you may just call it. You may just tell them just to ride home. It's not worth pushing through. But on the flip side of that, maybe it would be worth lowering it just so they could get through it, so they feel like they've accomplished something and you finish the ride feeling like you got something done. I'd say that's more from like the perspective of the athlete and how they would feel after the session, I guess. And it's probably, this is this thing between coach and athlete, knowing them very well and trying to figure out exactly how they react to situations like this.
Yeah, I think my thinking would be very similar. I can think of athletes I've worked with in the past or ridden with in the past that they need to be able to finish each session, or they're contemplating quitting the sport after it if they don't tick all the boxes, whereas others are happy to say, all right, that was just an off day. I'll recover for later in the week. The other thing that would be a massive factor for me is the timing of the session during the micro cycle. So whether it's that there's a Rico day the next day already scheduled, then almost always I'd be saying, look, you can afford to be in a lot of pain, try and hold as high a percentage of the prescribed intensity as possible, and we'll see how you feel at the end of your rest day the following day. Whereas if the complete other end of that is coming towards a race, I would always be saying go straight home and don't do any more damage if that's the way you're feeling. And also if it's something where I really want them to be able to do consecutive hard days, I don't want them to get to the point where they're unable to complete sessions early on in that block. Jason, have you got nothing?
Okay. I have something now. Okay. Tank. Yes. I've been writing down notes on the back of a gum package because I left my notebook on my couch. I didn't want to get up for it. So first of all, like, I think I'm a little bit different in how I prescribe my efforts in terms of HIIT. So we're talking about high intensity interval training here because that's probably the thing that athletes are going to fail on the most. It's like if you're going to give them a form sprint interval session or something like, or form drills or something like that, the chance of them failing on that are low unless they're crashing. Since the HIIT is the most likely thing to fail on, I guess I'll tackle that. I think it comes down to how you're going to prescribe your efforts. So, you know, if you're going to prescribe a VO2 max style or zone effort, then you have set up the zones and you want the athlete to be within that zones. I guess some coaches would prescribe something a little bit more in depth, I guess, or something a little bit more specific. That runs into an epistemological problem for me, so I don't do that. How I prescribe my intervals, like a 5x5 session, what I would have them do it as a maximal effort, what I'm expecting from them is based on, you know, where their chronic training load is tracking. And so, yeah, if they come out and they're not hitting the numbers that they want to hit, and I actually do a lot of my interval training with my athletes here in Perth. So we have regular sessions on Wednesday. So I'm right there with them. And if it's a one-off, because I'm there, I'm not too worried about it. And if they tell me that their numbers are down, which could be, you know, even if we model them into the session and their TSB looks good and everything like that, it could be just because it's a cold morning or something like that and their numbers are off. That happens sometimes. So if it's that case, especially if I'm right there, I usually just tell them to continue with the effort and put in the effort. And just put in maximize effort, even if the watts are down. So, and the reason that is based on the some of what I'm extrapolating off of the research for my PhD, whereby, you know, the hot group had a higher cardiovascular strain potentially, but the power numbers were down. And so I say, you know, try to match your heart rate as much as you can, which heart rate isn't always the best indicator of cardiovascular strain in all situations. But I just kind of say, just continue with the effort, unless obviously there's some kind of like injury or something, or they're like just having their soul crushed by it. But if it's just a day where they're a little bit off, then I'm just going to tell them to push through it. And then we like kind of do the post-mortem on it, you know, how did you eat, that type of thing. And I might just have them push through it too. Like sometimes I have new athletes that don't really understand, are still kind of fighting me on the idea of having easy days or easier days going into interval sessions. Sometimes I'll have athletes be like, when they first start with me, they'll like to have a hard group ride or something that isn't very easy on the Tuesday before we do intervals. And it's a good learning experience for them. I'm like, "Mom, my numbers aren't where I want them, coach." I'm like, "Well, what did you do yesterday?" "Oh, I went out on a hard group ride. Remember when I said we probably shouldn't do that?" "Well, this is a good learning experience for you, isn't it?" "Yeah, it is." So yeah, sometimes you just, it's coaches or coaching athletes can be just kind of like working with kids, I guess. Damien would know more about that than me or Cyrus. But you just, sometimes you have to let them have their little failures, and then they learn it from experiences, and that can be a little bit more impactful than you trying to tell them, you know, these are the things that you need to do to get good results. And I think that's all I have for that right now.
Yeah. I think, yeah, there's some really good points in there. And I think that's part of it is setting out if it's a max session, like a session where the numbers are going to be variable depending on how the athlete feels or whether they're on a good or bad day. It's important to let the athlete know that, which, yeah, clearly you've done. If they've told them to do 5 max intervals, they know that they're not desiring to hit a specific number. And because some athletes are so numbers and data driven, if you give them a number to hit and they can't hit it, then yeah, they don't see any worth in the session or that kind of thing. Yeah. So I think, yeah, in that way, that prescription is, yeah, going to aid some athletes really well. And then I've found myself personally, I would prefer to have that number to target just because I tend to find myself digging deeper if I've got that number there that I think, right, I have to hit this for this interval, which is obviously in a race isn't transferable whatsoever because you're not looking down at the number, you're trying to go to the finish line the fastest. But I would just find it mentally easier to focus on a number rather than in my head thinking this is going to be a max effort. But then you do have the converse of that, which is that if you suddenly can't hit that number, then it is a lot more challenging. Whereas if it's simply a max interval, you think, oh, well, I can only do as well as I can do. So,
yeah, I think the framing is important, definitely.
Yeah, I would say that you could still have numbers to shoot for in that. And one of the exercises that I have my athletes do is that when they're done with the interval session, I have them average all of the average watts for the work intervals. And so they put that number down in their session notes. So they'd have that number for next time to target. And then if you get through 4 of those efforts at that average or above it, maybe, hopefully, you have that 5th one to just knock out at an all out effort. And that one might go up or down. Yeah, you can still have numbers to target in that situation. And so I still feel it's kind of the best of both worlds. And Damien, you were saying?
Yeah.
I'll just add one area, because I was thinking about this, and in my younger coaching days, I may have actually prescribed sessions that I knew the athlete couldn't do. Now, I've changed a little bit since then. I'm a little bit more respectful of the athlete and the efforts because that it's maybe it works for some people in some ways, but it's I don't think it's the best way to coach. But the way I've reframed certain sessions, if we're looking to test something, but it's not like an outright test, I'll say like, this is the challenge. So if we're looking for a time to exhaustion at a certain number, for example, I'll say, okay, you got to make 60 minutes minimum and then just see how long you can go. And the same with knowing, like setting a baseline or knowing where someone is at first time they're kind of doing intervals, I'll say, all right, we're aiming for four, but you can go on and do as many as you can as a challenge to see exactly where you are, rather than saying, here is, you know, four, five, six efforts or whatever at a crazy high number, and you know that they're just going to fail. It just doesn't help anybody.
I will add the one criticism that I would give of my own, my approach is what happens after a couple of years or not even that long, the athlete just gets tired of approaching intervals that way, which I have a solve for that, but I get, I don't know if that's a necessarily a new topic, but there is that psychological drain of having to look at an interval session and saying, wow, I have to do this at the hardest prescribed, instead of like, well, if you have numbers, if you have numbers and you're just shooting for targets, well, if you're in really good shape and you're shooting it for that number and it's a bit lower than what you need, then, well, then it wasn't that hard of an effort. And so I would definitely say there's sometimes, even when I'm doing my intervals, I undershoot, and some of it's probably because I'm like, wow, if I don't have anything on any races on the calendar, then I might not be performing those intervals the best that I could. You're saying, Cyrus, I have one other thought, but like,
yeah, I think a big part of it again there is the framing of it, and a lot of that comes down to the athlete's own psychology. So there's, you can look at a max effort and think, all right, this is going to be maximum amount of pain, because pain is often the thing that's stopping you from going harder at those levels, and it's quite daunting. But alternatively, you can think, well, I don't have to be hitting a number, I just have to go as hard as I can go, and that's all it is. It's almost simple in a way that you don't get this performance anxiety of, oh, I have to get this result, because basically a power output for a certain time frame is a result in your training that you're trying to achieve. You're just thinking, okay, all I have to do is go as hard as I can. So from an athlete perspective, it's a matter of framing it then as well for the psychological stress involved in that training.
Yeah. So ironically, pacing an interval session so that you have the maximal amount of watts that you can attain average over the session, right? So you're looking for, it would be the hardest session you could, and theoretically the power, average power output for each one of those intervals would be relatively close to each other, yet by the time you did it, you felt like you couldn't go any harder. Pacing like that surprisingly isn't the hardest way to pace interval sessions. Anecdotally, and I probably have some science to back this up, but if you pace intervals where you do every single one is a maximal effort.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's going to be even harder mentally for an athlete to do. There is some data out there to show that that is a better way to get a greater time at or near VO2 max than if you were going to do it the way I prescribed, which then comes down to, hey, Jason, why aren't you prescribing your athletes to do intervals that way? And then my response is, go ahead and try doing it that way and see how many times you want to do intervals like that. it comes down to, again, like interval training endurance training comes down to the sustainability of things. I think it's a question about sustainability with that approach.
Yeah. And then just yeah, touching back to the session failure before we move on to our next topic, because we've obviously gone a bit down a tangent. Mm-hmm. But the one session I would always tell an athlete to keep going on, even if the intensity is dropping, is race simulation sessions, because often that is more a case of trying to just get a big load in one day, like a big, pretty high stress training stress score in there, and really just simulate that feeling of not feeling like you can put out any more power at the end of the race and having to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. So a typical example of that with the athletes I work with is training up for Australian nationals, because the 2 weeks before our national championships, you can't do race simulation by entering other races because it's over Christmas and New Year's, and there tends to be just this perfectly badly timed gap in races. So the race simulation sessions are completely just athlete induced, where they're doing these epic days with some intervals at the end of them. And in that case, I'll often get athletes coming to me really frustrated saying, oh, I couldn't hit these numbers at all. And I'm saying, yeah, that's because you had 3,500 kJs before you even started the session. And that would be an instance where I would always say, no, just try and complete it, even though the numbers are down. And part of it is telling the athlete beforehand, look, this isn't going to be your prettiest looking interval session at the end of this day, but this is our goal here, is to prepare you for this race that's coming up.
Yeah, I think that's also a good time to go on feel as well.
Yeah.
Being pretty loose with the prescriptions, probably, but just the idea that, yeah, it's all going to be on feel. It's all, you have to use your instinct a lot more, especially on race day, and getting back into that feeling as well.
Yeah. And I'll often prescribe some efforts there blinded as well, which I like, athletes to do, because as sort of, Jason's strategies with his intervals, the main idea around that is just making sure an athlete's not holding themselves back by just hitting a number. So if you're doing some intervals blinded where they're not looking down at the numbers, then, they actually might find, I can do that even at the end of a crazy hard ride.
Yeah. I would take a moment to interject a little, when you have a hammer, everything is a nail here. But one thing that I would consider, being the environmental physiology guy here, is, what are the environmental conditions? If you're sending out an athlete to do an interval session and it's 35 degrees out, of course they're not going to hit the numbers. And, as long as, things are healthy and they don't have to worry about falling over and hitting their head or anything like that, the interval sessions should be still okay to do. And again, as long as they don't have to worry about, heat stress type crazy sickness or anything like that. So that's another thing to kind of, some athletes don't have that wherewithal to I'm at altitude, or I'm at in really hot temperature, or it's really cold and I didn't warm up really well and my numbers are down. What's going on with my numbers? So there is a little bit of talking with your athlete about, everything from environmental conditions to, as we said before, the how much they've recovered before going into the session, and nutrition before the session. All these things should be kind of tackled and discussed with the athlete, and bad workouts give a chance to open up that discussion.
But it's funny you mentioned the heat thing, because I had that happen last week actually, where I had 3x10 minutes on a program. The rider did 3x5 minutes, and we were trying to figure out what was going on, and then I had a look at their file, and their core body temp with the core unit peaked before they even started the efforts at 39.37 degrees, and it was 32 degrees outside. I was like, no wonder. And then the heart rate was really high after the efforts as well. I was like, man, we're going to change something here. And we did a similar session a few days later, but earlier in the day, made sure the efforts were closer to the start of the ride, so it was as cool as possible. And the difference was that the core body temp peaked after the efforts they were able to get through. And then I think the average temp for the day was 26 degrees or something. I don't know how closely like that's related, but it definitely was a good indicator that that must be have something to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's important to discuss with the athlete then in conditions such as those that the adaptation, you might get the same adaptation for doing 20 watts less in your efforts or doing them for a shorter amount of time because, and Jason is obviously a lot more across this than I am, but the idea of like the training intervention isn't measured on the power in that you're putting through your cranks, mm-hmm. like as much as that's the only thing that we can actually look at often, but it's actually what you're doing inside your body that's going to count. Yep. So many athletes would just get so focused on that. And unfortunately, the only thing that changes the CTL is the power that's going through as well. Mm-hmm. But the actual training benefit is going to be the same, even if the power is much lower and you're training in those conditions.
Yeah. It gets into a kind of a longer discussion probably for probably some another episode about like where the benefits are and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's true. And at the end of the day, pragmatically, I just say try to get through the session as best you can, put in the hard effort. And if there's something like they're overtrained or something like that, I think with like the approaches to with the training load modeling and that type of stuff, it's really rare, I think, to get athletes that are overreached or overtraining unless there's something really bad going on. It's totally possible, but it's almost it's like whooping cough or something like that. You know, it's like a episode of House, and you're like, what is this we're looking at? Oh, he has smallpox, you idiot. No, you know, you're like, well, we haven't seen smallpox before. So I don't know where I'm going with that, but like just the fact that like it's rare to see an athlete quitting a session because of because they're overtrained or something like that. I think if you're using training load modeling and that type of stuff, just because overtraining doesn't come out of nowhere.
I would say the same thing, that in that most athletes, if you're working with a coach that's across everything and monitoring closely, it is a very rare occurrence that you would get that. So, and ideally you have as few of those days as possible where you can't complete the sessions, mm-hmm. because they're obviously mentally frustrating for the athlete, and then also a day that you end up having to change the program ahead and do some sort of diagnosing of what's gone wrong there. So the less of those, the better.
Well, imagine not having these tools.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely. While I think we've pretty much said all we have there, does anyone in the audience have any questions on that particular topic before we move on? Raise your hand if you feel at any point, but looks like we're good to move on to your topic, Damien. What have you been thinking about this week?
Cool. Well, end of last week, I kind of put my hand up to help someone train for an Ironman, a half Ironman, which started me down this really kind of big rabbit hole and looking at how to best place three sports. But I'm not going to go off into a triathlon thing here. It sort of came to this point where I was like, okay, how do you actually structure a week and be able to get the most out of each session? How do you fuel for these sessions? So it came down to this thing of like when designing any weekly program, whether that is triathlon or cycling or whatever, is thinking it not necessarily in the way of the training that you're doing, but the recovery. So how long do you need to recover from a day of training, and when can you get back to a good solid workout the next time? The thing with the triathlon stuff was it just you put it all into a week, and it just seems like there's so much going on. So it's a little bit different to cycling, but it still applies. You know, like when do you put your hard rides in? What does it look like the day before? How does that impact that? Do you need a rest day after? Like all these small considerations. And the one thing that I sort of came back to was looking at doing this around the carbohydrate combustion and availability. And it was kind of the thing that was driving my decisions when I was looking at the first week of training for the triathlon stuff. And I don't want to get into the weeds here. So I want to cut it, you know, like there's a lot of things you can do with expenditure and intake. There's, you know, like tracking intake and food diaries and things, and then detailed expenditures and things. And then there's like outside of that, there's the restricted carbohydrate availability, training interventions and carbohydrate periodization. So it can get really, really confusing. But in simple terms, if we just think about it, how much carbohydrate will you potentially burn in a session and how much time do you need to fill up those stores again? And then how does that kind of impact training? So one thing I do have here, I've got a couple of examples of two sessions just to kind of give an idea of what I'm talking about. So if we talk about fuel availability and fuel use in two different types of sessions. So we have a, like if we have a HIIT session and then we just have like a low intensity session. So if we have a 5x5 session, they're making a huge, huge showing today.
So inside joke.
If we think about those 5x5s, they just pop up everywhere. 70 minute HIIT session and 140 minute low intensity session. If you kind of work down through, by the time you have warm-ups and warm downs, you've got the main part of the session. So 90 minutes steady or the 5x5, pretty much you will get to the same amount of carbohydrate needed to fuel both those sessions, around 210, 220. And of course that depends on the athlete, et cetera. But as an example, so you can see two totally different sessions, but and different durations, and they need the same carbohydrate intake. So for me, this shows like the importance of having high carbohydrate availability for the HIIT sessions, for example, because yeah, the impact of the fueling can impact the session and then how it's performed and then the adaptations as a result of that. So I'm interested from both of you how you do it and how you think about this. I want to say that it does start to get a bit complicated once you get into the weeds here. Things that are helping me make the decisions at the moment are kind of these metabolic tests where they're modeling fueling based on specific power intensities. That's kind of helping me make decisions around fueling the work, the actual work, but kind of how where these sessions are placed, and doing some rough calculations around that. But overall, for me personally, I think it's a lot of trial and error and figuring out exactly how someone responds and how they feel during a session with a specific load, how well they can recover based on other factors in their life outside of cycling, and how they can get the fuel in time. So probably, I don't know, starting with Jason, is this something you think about? Do you think about carb burn and store replenishment when designing a week?
No. I mean, a little bit, but I try to keep it pretty pragmatic. And I don't know, is it pragmatism or nihilism? One of the two. I think. We talk about training load models a lot. I think part of the calculation, to an extent, kind of serendipitously takes that into account. If you were going to look at the Bannister model, it just kind of it works, right? So, in terms of, you know, whether you're going to carb load, it really gets into some rabbit holes here. Some of it's kind of like, well, how do you even trust the calculation method that you're using to demonstrate that the carbohydrates have been burned that you say that have been burned? And that's just a question I would have, because I don't really have a lot of knowledge about the literature that's out there. Some nutritionists might come and tell me that he can get really accurate with it. Actually, when you brought up this topic, I was like, we're probably going to end up opening up this topic and just kind of talking about it candidly. And at the end of the day, I'm just going to say, we should bring Dr. Sam Impey on the show and talk to him about it, because he's going to be like the expert that I would consult on this. And I would read his literature, whatever. So I guess some of the approaches that are out there, you know, you could be talking about the low carb diet versus the high carb diet versus a kind of polarized kind of, not polarized training, but a polarized type of eating where you are, you know, low carb during some sessions and high carb during others. And once you start to make claims around this, I think, again, like, you want to have a good training study to back up what you're doing. And the last time I had any kind of exposure to this, I think there was one study that was looking at polarized nutrition, carbohydrate intake versus low carbohydrate intake versus high carb calorie intake. And it was with race walkers with Louise Burke. And I want to say the low carb did the worst. And I think there wasn't any differences between polarized and high carb. But don't quote me on that. I would definitely say people should look that up before quoting me on that. So that's kind of my extent. And then it gets into this thing of amateur athletes versus professional athletes and cost versus benefits and how much time are you going to have this athlete work on this and that type of thing. So, you know, someone with a day job, getting into the nitty gritties of nutrition gets kind of tough. So it gets into what we've talked about before with the plates that they give athletes to kind of help visualize the amount of food that you're going to eat and that type of stuff. So, yeah, but so those are just kind of my thoughts on it right now without diving really super deep into it. And yeah, something that is on my list of things to read more about. And like I said, I'd love to see, love to have Sam on the show and talk about it. If he's out there, he does a lot of podcasts. So yeah, that's all I have.
Yeah, I'll jump in. So I think this is to answer the question you asked to Jason, I also wouldn't factor it into my training, but I wouldn't factor it into my own training or the training I prescribe to athletes, and look at whether I'm going to be able to replenish, glycogen stores and have that carbohydrate available in time. It wouldn't be something I'd factor in, but as Jason was kind of pointing to, it's something that would happen anyway with a standard training load model. And if you, I think once you've got triathlons, because you're doing multiple sessions every day, then it is adding another factor, and it's something that I'd find myself looking into more then. But because predominantly I'm prescribing one session a day and completing one session a day myself, and then it wouldn't be something I'd use to change my training, but it is certainly a discussion I'd have with the athlete. So I think the most common misconception is just the amount you need to eat on a training day in carbohydrates to get back to square. I would often direct my athletes to an article I have on my own website on just that goes very mathsy into just the amount of carbohydrates burnt. And obviously you're just relying on some models which may not be all that accurate and will obviously fluctuate a lot depending on the athlete. But if you look at the calorie expenditure during a hard training ride where the average watts are up there, then, and if it's at an intensity where carbohydrate is the predominant substrate for fuel, then I think the just this constantly athletes will completely underestimate how much they need to eat. And then the most common thing I find with athletes I'm speaking to is I just cannot stop eating on my rest days. I like whatever happens, I'm just eating the whole day. I just have to reinforce that's because you're so in so much deficit from the day before. And they said, yeah, but I ate the whole day before. Like I was eating the whole time on my ride and I had carbs for dinner. But just, yeah, so many athletes, just it's so beneficial having a discussion to let them know how much carbohydrate is actually being utilized when they're riding. So they have that idea of how much they have to eat on those days. And then to touch on fueling sort of during the session and around the session, I like to work with athletes, especially in those race simulation sessions I was discussing earlier, on practicing fueling. So getting your fueling strategy sorted, and then particularly, yeah, the timing of the food before, what food you're eating, and then during the ride, because the amount of times you just hear someone saying, oh, I could have won that race, but gastric issues like stomach upset or whatever, and or just, yeah, had a stitch, had a sore tummy, had whatever the issue is. And I've definitely been there myself, and I'd say like most athletes have been there themselves, and it is super frustrating. But if it's something that you neglect in training, then it's something that you can face the consequences of in a race. So sort of to link back around, it's not something I would factor into the training plans that I'm setting out, but it's definitely something that is important to discuss with every athlete, and in particular beginners.
Yeah, it's very true. Very true.
Yeah, I think it really becomes important if you start going down this sort of training intervention with restricted carbohydrate availability and things, because you have to plan it out more, because otherwise there's potential for bad things to happen, whether that is training or just burning an athlete out or anything like that. But the one big takeaway that I got from it was, after I was making these daily calculations or just looking at training sessions a bit more closely and the burn rate based on modeling and stuff, you know, someone having a 3-hour ride with mostly endurance stuff and then a little bit of tempo. At their tempo, they're burning 200 grams of carbs an hour in the model. So just having an understanding that even at that level, you really start burning a lot. And so not only really thinking about the fueling during the ride, but then trying to get it in afterwards as well. And that was just the biggest thing that I sort of had an aha moment with this week was the careful considerations around exactly what type of intensities you're doing, and just thinking about fueling that and having a bit more of a strategy rather than just going into it and saying, I'm just going to have just 60 grams an hour or 70 grams an hour and then that's it, but not understanding exactly how much you need to have a good session at bare minimum.
Yeah. And I think it's important to just keep in mind the big picture goal, which is mostly to increase performance and go faster on your bike for anyone that you're coaching. And if fueling is compromising that ability, then it's something that needs to be addressed. So if it's, yeah, if you are unable to complete sessions like we were discussing earlier because of fueling, which could definitely be a factor in why an athlete all of a sudden goes out one day and can't do a desired thing, then it's definitely, I would say there's no instance where it's worthwhile, whatever the nutrition intervention is, to sacrifice the training intervention. Obviously there's situations where you'd plan around that. So you'd plan your lower glycogen level rides, you're intentionally under fuel. It's probably not a nice way to describe it, but you would have that planned in the program, and you're obviously not going to be doing your HIIT sessions on that day. But yeah, if there is a case, and it may be an athlete going rogue where they've read all of this literature, or often in most cases, a tiny pocket of the literature and then tried to apply it to everything. If that is becoming an issue, then it's something that needs to be addressed straight away, because I think, yeah, paramount is just the performance side of things first.
Now, if they've been listening to or watching Tim Noakes' Twitter feed.
There's pretty endless amounts of ways for people to find information that'll take them down some pretty tumultuous paths.
Endless memes. I don't really have any other thoughts about that. Just something that, you know, I have a whole bunch of papers that I've collected over the years. I'm like, I should get to those at some point.
Cool. So I think we've addressed all of that.
I just wanted to take a quick break here to say thanks for stopping by and listening to the show, and to give you a quick reminder about who we are and where you can find us. The show is a collaborative project between sports scientist and cycling coach Dr. Jason Boynton, professional cyclist and cycling coach Cyrus Monk, and myself, Damien Roos, professional cycling coach and author of the Cycling Science Digest. If you want to get in touch with any of us or find out more about what we do, check out the show notes of this episode for links to each of our websites or social media accounts. Also, a reminder that you can be part of the show too. We host the show live on Clubhouse every week. Just search Clubhouse for the Cycling Performance Club and you'll see our scheduled room. And with that, let's get back into it.
So I think we'll go on now to Jason's topic, which we got a little preview of last week because he's thinking more than a week in advance. But we'll hear from Jason what he's thinking.
I was excited for this one. And to be honest, it's a little like that training plan topic that we had, where it was one of those things where I'm something about it just irked me. So you read on, you know, maybe these bicycle magazines, cycling magazines, or training blogs, that type of thing. And you have these workouts that claim that they increase FTP. And these have always kind of like irked me in like a just kind of this visceral way. But I never really had took the time to just think about it and figure out what it was until I read one that was by a sports scientist, and I was like, you should know better. So after a fair bit of deliberation on this issue, I've come to my conclusion. And what I'm going to do today with you guys is I'm going to lay out my conclusion. And then I'm just going to break down the argument piece by piece, and then I'll have like places in there to kind of stop and get your guys' thoughts on it, just to make sure my thinking on this is correct. So my thought is, here's my conclusion. That is, there is no workout that increases FTP in well-trained cyclists. And to clarify that, the subtitle of that is the assertion that certain workouts have the sole benefit and ownership over increasing FTP demonstrates a significant misunderstanding of current endurance training science. And that's, I wrote that down so I could say it all and complete. And so today I'm on a mission to kill some cherished beliefs. And so I guess just a little bit of clarification again about these workouts. You know, you're going to find them in layman's training blogs and potentially videos on YouTube and that type of thing. And so I actually today I went out and I went into this realm as much as I try to avoid it. I think I've made the joke with Damien that I have a threshold of 2 layman's training articles a day. Otherwise, I just get fed up with it. For me, I'd just rather
elitist.
I know. Thank you. Thank you. I was like, yes, very elitist. But, you know, I do it for the podcast. I did it for the podcast today. So if we could
thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
So if there's any listeners, just for all my trials and tribulations, if you could give us a share.
The suffrage.
For the suffering. The suffering I had to go to today, reading training blogs and watching training videos on YouTube. So basically, what are they? And from my little quick analysis, what I found was is that they just seem to be like all over the board. Some are high intensity interval training. Some are sprint. Some say increase the duration of your rides, but overwhelmingly the style or the type of workout that claim to increase FTP are workouts that train in or around the functional threshold power zone. So that'd be like sweet spot workouts, lactate threshold workouts, that type of thing.
5x5.
So they're all in that kind of Coggin zone range. I'll just stop right there. Is this something that you guys are familiar with? Have you seen these articles, these videos, that type of thing? I guess I don't know if we can name names or not. I don't care. One of the articles I was on, or one of the videos I watched was with Cycling Global, GCN. It was a Global Cycling Network. And that was a struggle to get to, but, yeah, so do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, GCN was front of mind when you were talking about that. And just, I'm not across the Zwift sphere, but the amount of screenshots I've seen of just FTP builder workouts people's Strava, just FTP builder, all of these different things, which it's pretty much guaranteed that each FTP builder workout you look at will be different to the last one. But yeah, that's the classic one. And if I was getting into it and thought I want to increase my FTP and then saw one of those workouts, I'd probably do it as well.
Yep. So Damien, I suppose you're aware of those types of articles, those types of claims around workouts as well.
I don't think I've seen one or read one in a long time, but I'm aware of this thinking. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I think just talking about like what is FTP, I guess it would be a good thing to start with. And this FTP is something that Andrew Coggin made up, and it's not necessarily scientifically valid. It was more just kind of a pragmatic way to trying to have his own type of critical power. In this conversion that is often used to calculate FTP, we talked about that quite a bit in a few episodes ago, where, you know, the 0.95 conversion for a 20-minute power has not really been validated. It wasn't when they came out with it, or scientifically. I mean, there's some research on it now. But when we talk about scientific thresholds, physiological thresholds, we talk about lactate threshold 1 and 2 and ventilatory threshold 1 and 2. And there's a little bit of literature out there and how FTP relates to those, but it's important to point out that these things are different. And so FTP, where FTP relates to the actual physiological zones that are important to train, is not necessarily the same thing. It gets into the, well, why are we increasing FTP? Well, obviously it's a component of endurance performance. We've talked about this before, and even for someone who is a pro sprinter in the pro peloton, they still would have a very high functional threshold power in order to compete, higher than most amateurs would. Okay, so getting back into the functional threshold, I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about just FTP in general that you want to throw in there off the bat.
Yeah, it's pretty important in to have a high FTP in professional cycling. I think if you could tell anyone that you could increase their FTP, then they would pay you a lot of money to do that for them. So yeah, it's definitely a priority for most athletes.
Yeah, so you can see why it is a priority. That's a really good point. Like it's a priority because it correlates really highly with how you're going to perform in competition, right? Thresholds is very important for endurance athletes. So jumping back into the topic where we were talking about, you know, types of workouts that claim to increase functional threshold power, I want to go into some of the arguments that I had for it. So first thing that like stands out to me is the principle of specificity, or the specificity principle. And so you would think if you train at threshold, that would allow you to increase threshold, which is a fair assertion and a fair reasoning. And not only on top of that, it's functional threshold power. And there's a bit of skill to maintaining power at a maximal amount over a certain time. So that gets into pacing. So doing efforts at threshold or near threshold are arguably going to help you pace. And if you improve your pacing, you could increase your FTP. Another argument that I've come across for it, or evidence, or what might be justifying people's thinkings on this, is in the Coggin and Hunter Allen book, and you guys might remember this, there's a table in there and it's called expected physiological and performance adaptations for zones. And it's like table 3.2 in the second edition. So, and if you look at zone 4, which is lactate threshold, the lactate threshold zone in the book, you'll notice that there's 4 plus signs in the table for increasing lactate threshold. So the lactate threshold zone is the best way to increase lactate threshold according to Coggin's book. Because and in terms of like pluses, 4 pluses is like the maximum amount of pluses I think anything gets on that table anywhere. So, you know, there's a big assertion that training at this zone is going to benefit your threshold, according to Coggin and Hunter's book. The other argument is that, well, untrained and recreationally trained cyclists will definitely benefit from this type of training, but it doesn't really say much because they will benefit from just about any kind of training. And the last argument that I've come across is with Inigo San Milan, and I want to say, Damien, you've listened to some of his stuff, and I've also listened to some of his stuff, but it's I haven't had a chance to go back and listen to his thing, but he does do training that takes consideration of lactate threshold, but I don't think he's using Coggin's zones necessarily, so it's hard to say where it sits physiologically in comparison.
I think when he talks about his zone 2, which is like the main thing that he talks about, he's talking about a specific lactate level, blood lactate level. I can't remember what it was, like 1.8 millimoles or something.
So it's
a very individual.
Yeah, so it's hard for me to be like, well, is this below LT1 or above LT1? So without listening to him and understanding where his arguments are around that, I don't know. But yeah, Cyrus, have you heard any other arguments that could potentially promote the idea of using functional threshold power or sweet spot training to improve FTP?
Yeah, that's the classic old Lance one. Was he just swore by always training just below, and because that will push it up, and he thought if you trained above, it would push it down. So, and that was, I think, like pretty widely used in the 90s and early 2000s, I think. Like, and that's something that unfortunately guys from that era that are coaches now will just still swear by that because that's what worked for them. So it's definitely something that is still used a lot, just that theory of, yeah, sweet spot, so just below your FTP or at around that intensity, and that will push it up is the theory. Mm,
yeah. That's interesting. But again, like if it's, you know, if we're talking about lactate threshold, then that's just, that's kind of a line. Well, depending on which one he's talking about, LT1 or LT2. And if it's below LT1, then that's just low intensity training, right? That's just so, and yeah, I guess I don't want to get into too many tangents, but yeah, I hadn't heard that one. But I had heard things like, you don't want to become acidic, I guess, or produce a lot of lactic acid when you're training, because that affects your ability to adapt. And there is some evidence around mitochondrial biogenesis and acidosis to kind of back that up. I think it was with rats last time I saw a study on, I don't forget if they did it in humans or not yet, but that's kind of some of David Bishop's work, but not super strong evidence. And the other thing is like with FTP, FTP is probably actually higher than these threshold zones. So yeah, you're getting back into like, that's not, maybe not what you would want to do.
The other one I just thought of there as well, the other rationale and sort of methodology I've heard is it's that zone. So if you're taking about 90% of FTP or, yeah, the high zone 3, low zone 4 is the best way for maximum kilojoule output, mm-hmm. with 2 intensity factor ratio, mm-hmm. or like to TSS ratio. So in that, the opposite of polarized training in a way, but you are then, yeah, getting the maximum energy output for each ride for minimum stress on the body, mm-hmm. in theory.
Yep.
So that's the other way of looking at it.
Yep. I've seen that. That's a chart that is also described in Coggins' book as well. So that's all I could come up with for, you know, arguments for using threshold or sweet spot training as a way to increase FTP. Which gets me into my next part of my train of thought here is the evidence against it, where functional threshold power and sweet spot training, the arguments for it kind of fall apart. And first thing for me, and this isn't totally damning, but for me, it's kind of a cardinal sin, is Hunter's and Coggins' table in their book, it has no sources, right? And so you have no idea how they quantified their pluses that they put in there. There's also no mention in the graph of the durations that you're supposed to hold those intensities for. And on that, I want to say, I remember having either a back and forth with Coggins somewhere. I think it was either on Facebook Messenger or it might have been when he was presenting a webinar or something like that. And I asked him about that and about his graph. And I said, where did you get those papers? Because I was interested in reading those papers. I wanted to read the primary literature because I'm into getting into classic papers like that. And his response was, 20 years of reading endurance training papers. So he couldn't even like cite one. He just said, this is just from my own experience. And so again, for me, that's kind of a cardinal sin because we have to take his word on it. It's an unfalsifiable. So and that means there's no way to adjust it over time when we come out with new research. And there's just no way, we have to just trust that what he says is correct. And that's just an argument from authority. And so, I've seen coaches cite this table and discuss this table like it's the Bible or something, like it's totally legit. And not to say it's totally wrong, but it's not scientific in nature at all, because we can't falsify it. We have no way to see what sources he has. And the other kind of point with the principle of specificity, I mean, yes, it's a good rule of thumb, I think, but it's not the end all be all. And we know this just by looking at, performance papers that did like weight training with trained cyclists and saw improvements, or added heat to training and saw improvements. And these are definitely not specific in a sense, but you can still see improvements in performance. So the idea that you have to train at threshold or near threshold in order to improve threshold is not necessarily true, and can be demonstrated as not, I don't want to say false, but not necessarily true, just by kind of looking at that. And so I think right now the best counter arguments that I've seen that kind of to go against lactate threshold and sweet spot training as a way to improve functional threshold power are these studies that look at training intensity distribution. And you guys are probably aware of those. It's just like, for most people, you know, those polarized training studies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And then for the audience is like, well, what is a training distribution study? And I don't know if any of you guys, Cyrus, are you going to jump in and explain what a training distribution study is, or do you have any idea?
Yeah, so yeah, basically for anyone listening, you're just taking a sample of someone's training over a number of weeks, or obviously a population's training over a number of weeks, and looking at the percentage of time they're spending in each zone. So it depends on the zone model you're using. So often these will be done with a three zone model.
Yep, exactly.
The polarized study ones. So that is your zone one would be below LT1, which is the first lactate threshold, and that's entirely aerobic. Well, obviously not entirely, but
lots of aerobic. Lots of aerobic.
And then predominantly aerobic system is supplying the energy there. And then between LT1 and LT2, which would be the sweet spot stuff and where you would see your threshold sitting, and then, well, your FTP. And then, so that would be your zone two. And then zone three is above LT2, which a lot of people will correlate the FTP with LT2. And that is... anything in that zone three then would be anaerobic. And basically you're looking...
I wouldn't say it's anaerobic, right? It's just above... It's above threshold. Above threshold.
Yeah.
There's still aerobic
above
component there.
Threshold. Yeah. So, yeah, still a lot of aerobic contribution, and then more of a contribution from anaerobic means. And then basically these training distribution studies are looking at the time spent in each of these zones. So... predominantly for us as endurance cyclists, even if you're looking at a sprinter, they will be spending the vast majority of their training in that zone one. So yeah.
I'll just cut you off here, because I just wanted a break to think, and I know you do a really good job on explaining just like how the studies are laid out but one of the things to mention within these training distribution studies is there's another split with them, is to look at them retrospectively, right? So they would be looking at professional cyclists or something like that and collecting all their training data and looking back to see what they actually did, right? So there's a number of studies like that. That's actually pretty easy to do. And then the other type of study that's with this is prospective studies, where the scientists would come in and they'd have a group of cyclists and they would say, like, hey, you guys are all going to train this way and you guys are all going to train this way. And so there's a much more controlled study, a lot harder to do this. So what the retrospective studies say is there's the athletes, professional endurance athletes are generally using like either a polarized or a pyramid type training distribution. And there's not a whole lot of athletes that are doing a lot of threshold training or a lot of time in zone two or around threshold. And the prospective studies where there's not a lot of those, but the ones that I've seen and the meta-analysis that I was looking at on it is that when you do polarized training compared to threshold training, the benefits to threshold are better, right? And so we're looking at in those prospective studies where they did total polarized, where they were totally polarized, right? They saw greater improvements in threshold without any time at threshold, right? So that just, to me, that says like, well, you can increase threshold without any time, and you can increase it better without any time spent in sweet spot or lactate threshold. So that is probably one of the biggest nails in the coffin for the whole threshold and functional threshold power workouts that claim to increase threshold. It's not to say they don't at all. It's not to say there is no benefit from it, but there is to say that it's obviously not the best way to do it, because you can increase threshold power and performance by not spending any time in the zone by quite a bit, and better than if you were going to spend more time in the threshold. And I think that's what I have in terms of like things, in terms of arguments against the functional threshold power and sweet spot training zones. I don't know if you guys have any other things, any other like kind of counters to sweet spot workouts and lactate threshold workouts as these awesome ways to improve functional threshold power. Damien, do you have any thoughts?
I've been trying to think about exactly what types of sessions I prescribe around this, and I'm having a hard time coming up with any time that I would just go straight out, prescribe something at FTP and say the purpose is strictly to increase FTP.
Mm-hmm.
I work around it a lot, but yeah, if I'm doing any type of prescribed workout at FTP, it's for those reasons that you mentioned, like the specificity of it, the learning how to put the force through the pedal and the pacing, all the things that you can't, like it's a very specific intensity to sit at. It's difficult and uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
but it's not impossible to sit there for longer periods. But it does take time to wrap your head around actually being able to sit at that zone and just get used to it. You don't get comfortable, but I think you get used to it. But I'm kind of interested then, where does lactate production and lactate clearance come into this discussion? Because these are the physiological thresholds that we're talking about that are close to FTP, but how do they fit into the discussion? How do they contribute to FTP, if at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess for me, based on those prospective training intensity distribution studies, I think for me, what it kind of points to is that the physiological adaptations that would reduce would reduce lactate and blood lactate or muscle lactate, those things can be stimulated without being there. All right. So again, I think right now the standing is that with trained athletes that mitochondrial biogenesis best occurs with volume over intensity. So if mitochondria, if you could point to mitochondria and say, well, you know, these are part of, you know, if you can point at that and say like, well, this is part of the equation that reduces lactate production, then you can see how at least in one sense, how it is possible to stimulate your ability to, or improve your ability to sit at threshold without sitting at threshold. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay. The next part of the kind of train of thought here is the rebuttal or the devil's advocate for the person that would be pro FTP, sweet spot zone training, or I call it my notes here, sweet spot strikes back. So first of all, as you said, Damien, and you pointed out, I wouldn't say that I've never prescribed workouts in these zones. I just had one of my athletes enter the room, and he will tell you that I prescribe 2x20s to him every once in a while. He's not a fan, but he does get them. But there's not necessarily the end result is to be like, well, this is for improving threshold training. Or this is, you know, the end result here is not to improve functional threshold power. And I'm certainly not saying there's zero benefit to threshold and sweet spot zone training. Right? It's just not necessarily, I think it's just myopic to think that training in threshold necessarily improves threshold in the best way. And so the other kind of response here that I could potentially have is just kind of nitpicking these intensity distribution studies. And so I'll get into, you know, I'll take a moment to be critical of them. So first of all, the way these studies are done, from my understanding, they are not really great for determining like what type of workouts you've performed. Would you agree with that, Cyrus? Like, for example, I'll just give you an example and see. So you could have a certain percentage that you spend in zone four. So you could be in zone four for maybe 10% of your training time, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that athlete experienced zone four in a physiologically meaningful way. So they could have had zone four because it was spaced over the course of five workouts because they climbed a hill too hard or something like that, as opposed to the zone four that they experienced was in a single workout that focused on zone four. So there's these studies aren't really good at showing what kind of workouts athletes are doing. They just show that like there was time spent in zone four. And I think most people would understand that the, you know, zone four heart rate, or since these are all based off of, I said zone four because it, we were talking about Coggins zones, so it's getting a little bit tricky.
So
in the studies, they're, you know, let's say like zone, they're talking zone two, which is our threshold zones, or again, with the studies, it has the three zones. And so let's say like in the studies, there's a certain percentage of the zone two, which is again, threshold zone, a little bit of confusion there. Sorry about that. Like I said, that zone two could be very different. It's all measured the same. I would say sitting in zone two after an hour is going to be a different physiological or stimulus than what zone two is after 2 minutes. So it doesn't, the studies don't really take that into account really great. So you got to be aware of that. I think the fact that they use heart rate for the distribution as opposed to power helps kind of normalize and kind of counter that argument a little bit. But yeah, it's just something to be aware of.
But do they add up time in zone or do they just do it per session? Like they average it out over the entire session?
That's a good question. And I think what they do is the way I understand it is because this is how they do it in Training Peaks. So I would imagine it's really similar. Is if you imagine like every second of your workout was like a little ping pong ball, right? And that ball had a 1, 2, or 3 on it. And you would just take all these ping pong balls and put them in basically containers. And whichever ping pong balls filled up the highest in that container would be how you determine the zone. So you're looking, you're taking like every second of all your workouts and dropping and figuring out what zone that second was in. And then you're just putting it in a big massive graph, like bar graph, basically. Hopefully that makes sense. At least, I mean, that's how they do it, would do it in Training Peaks to figure out distributions. I would imagine they're doing something really similar in these papers. So far, this is where I'm on the kind of the cusp of this, like I said, I'm just going to, and my next step is to get a little bit more into the actual studies, because I've been just reading like the meta-analyses and some of the reviews on the training distribution stuff. Yeah, so another kind of thing to consider with these is, one, with the retrospective intensity distributions, it's really important to point out that just because looking back at how these pros are training doesn't mean how they're training the best way. Because it might be just tradition or whatever, and we have plenty of talks on this podcast about how tradition isn't always the best way to approach things. So it could be, you could use the same argument for the retrospective studies. You're just like, well, they're traditionally not really training the right way. So, and
the other big thing to factor in with pros is the amount of time spent racing. Mm-hmm. And racing is where obviously there's no control over mm-hmm. that. But if you've got someone going to race Alpine Tour, like if they've just done the Dauphiné before coming up to the Tour de France, that is a hell of a lot of time in that zone two, in the three zone model, mm-hmm. because all of the climbs are essentially going to be in zone two, unless they're racing at the top or the small sections in zone three. But yeah, the majority of that day is, those days are going to be zone two. So even if they desire to use a polarized model in their training in a race situation, you don't have a choice. And those lead up races make up the majority of the training for a lot of athletes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just more reasons why the prospective studies are much better evidence for the argument I'm making. However, there's very few prospective studies out there. And this review came out in like 2018. So I want to see if there's been any more prospective studies to look at. And if you only have a few handful of studies, there's always kind of that argument that things could still regress to the mean and we might not be right on it. But right now, with the evidence that we have, it appears that, you know, that threshold and thresholds aren't necessarily increased best by riding at threshold. And the other thing is, if we have this very small set of prospective studies that have looked at training intensity distributions, we have an even smaller set that has looked at just well-trained cyclists. Because when you start, you know, there's the other prospective studies have looked at other endurance sports. But when you get into running and cross-country skiing and rowing, there's all different kinds of other factors that could fit into that training intensity distribution and could potentially be different. So this is one of the things that you want to kind of be careful of when you're extrapolating things for cycling off of studies that were done in other endurance sports. I think those are my main criticisms or things to be aware of around these training intensity distribution studies. And the last kind of argument that I had that the proponents of sweet spot training as a way to increase FTP, they could say, well, we're just ahead of the science, which I hate that argument. But it's like, well, how do you know you're ahead of the science if you don't have science to tell you you're ahead of the science? So, those are my pros, I think, are my criticisms those are my strike back comments. I don't know if you guys have any other things that kind of jump on to kind of make criticisms of the polarized training model studies or anything like that.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing is to do a prospective study on that with, like elite level cyclists, because I don't think I could see myself. I can't see any point in a year where someone would present me a 6-week study and I'd be able to say yes to either one or the other. Mm-hmm. And that's me who's keen to contribute to research. So when you've got others who are more reluctant, it's going to be even more difficult. But it's just with any racing in there, it's impossible to prescribe, because like you can even think, okay, well, like racing in Belgium is usually actually quite polarized in its nature, because it's either easy on the flat or punching in and out of corners up small bergs. Mm-hmm. But if there's a day I'm in a breakaway, then the entire day is in zone two. Mm-hmm. So like the being able to do a prospective study around people who are racing is going to be really difficult. Mm-hmm. And then for someone in a preparation phase, it's going to be difficult to tell them to completely have their training one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Because most cyclists are used to a combination of both methods and are going to be pretty reluctant to completely give up on training in one or two of those zones for a significant period of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was another criticism you could have of the actual prospective studies that they do. They have very small groups for the people that they're training. They're usually like 8 people or something like that. That's not, there's one that had like 48 athletes, but it was combined over runners, cyclists, triathletes, cross country athletes. So that was a little bit bigger cohort. But still, but you can say have that same criticism across sports science studies in general. So just moving on. So to the other types of workouts that you might see in these training blogs that would be promoted as ways to increase FTP, there's high intensity interval training. And then that gets down into like, okay, high intensity interval training definitely improves in performance, but then it's kind of like, okay, well, which one of those high intensity interval training sessions is the best, and how do you know it's the best? And how, you could say, well, we looked at time at or near VO2 max, and that should be a good way to determine which one's the best. And I can say that might not necessarily be true. And so the other thing is it gets into this kind of, where I'm going with this argument is that, okay, well, if we only use HIIT sessions, if that's the best way to get to where we want to go, then we could probably only do it 3 times a week, right? So you're not going to do HIIT sessions every day. And this is part of one of the arguments that I have is that if you take any one of these workouts, whether high intensity interval training or training in sweet spot or threshold, if it's the best way to increase functional threshold power, then wouldn't your functional threshold power improve linearly as you increase those workouts, the number of those workouts in your training? So if it's the best way to do it, then wouldn't your threshold get better as you incorporate it into your workouts 7 times a week? And everyone would be like, that's crazy. What are you doing? And I'm like, oh, obviously there's something else going on here. So we have to consider something else that's outside of these quote unquote workouts that are increased functional threshold power. So it's like, oh, so you can't do these every single day and hope to see a benefit. And so the same thing with a high intensity interval training. You can probably, they say 2 to 3 times a week. But if I only did high intensity interval training, but I decided to have lighter recovery rides in between those rides, yes, I've increased the amount of time that I've done the workouts, the volume of the training and the amount of kilojoules of work done, but I'm probably going to increase the performance as well. But I'm able to do that, but I wouldn't be able to add more sessions of HIIT into the week. But I could add more sessions of low intensity training. And so now I'm getting away from the point where it's not just one workout that is increasing FTP. Now I have at least 2 types of workouts. And then you could say, not high intensity training, not threshold training. Maybe low intensity training is the best way to increase functional threshold power as a single workout. And so maybe it's day after day after day of long rides at low intensities that increases threshold power. If you could ride enough to do that. But it still doesn't change the fact that at some point you would need a rest day. And maybe instead of incorporating a rest day, you could have a low volume day. And now all of a sudden you have 2 different types of workouts again. And where I'm going with this is functional threshold power is not about a single workout. It's about multiple different types of workouts at different intensities, different durations, and different loads. And so, again, getting back to my original kind of statement in the beginning, looking at a single workout as a way to increase FTP is very myopic. And I am Jason Boynton and I am done speaking. What do you guys think about that? I had just trying to finish this off kind of quickly because I know we're getting a little bit long here.
I don't have anything to add, really. I think you've made your points on a lot of different things. It seems like I've come to pretty similar conclusions without going through that entire process myself.
Yeah. I tried it. It was something different.
The idea that you want to go through step by step and actually figure out, you know, giving yourself reasons why you wouldn't do it is admirable, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's like part of it is as you're setting out a training plan, you want to have for each session a purpose of having the session in there and be able to justify that to the athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And with each session, there's also the possibility of saying, well, why should that be there? Why don't you have something else instead? And it's often, it can get to the point where if I hear someone saying, oh, I'm doing this session today, it's very easy to just say, ah, oh, that's a silly session. Why are you doing that? It's not that useful. But the reality is if there's a session, there isn't a session, like you said, that is the best session or the most useful session that we know of. So the is not just a possibility. And if there was, you still couldn't do that every day of the week or every day that you're not having recovery. So I think it's guaranteed that some sessions are going to be more beneficial to building FTP than other sessions. But I think in conclusion, really, it's going to be the mixture in the right order and spaced out properly over a training plan that's actually going to have the desired outcome of increasing the FTP.
Yeah. I think they'll eventually maybe write this up in an article and hopefully maybe publish it somewhere. And hopefully my thoughts will be a little bit more concise when I write them down. Thanks for the listeners that powered through that. The only counter they could have for this whole thing started like this. My counter argument for my whole rant here is functional threshold power isn't the end all be all for cycling training, which is true, right? There's other components to it. It's an important component, but it's not everything. And as we've discussed in earlier episodes, increasing cycling performance involves skills training and sprint training and other types of training outside of just trying to increase FTP. So these other types of training are important. So the argument could be, the counter argument for my spiel could be, is that like, yes, we know that FTP isn't going to increase linearly with every single session that we add in. We have to also add in these other sessions. And so interspersed between functional threshold power sessions, we would add these other types of sessions, which would be like sprint training and, you know, skills training and other types of training, whatever you want, stomp drills or whatever. Not that I would do those, but you get my point. So that's the only, like, that was the kind of playing devil's advocate with my own argument was this. And I guess, I mean, if you decided that your best way to increase functional threshold power was massive amounts of volume, and you intersperse those massive amounts of volume with these other types of training, I would say there's probably worse ways to train. I wouldn't necessarily say it would be the best, but it would work, I guess. Probably better than doing sweet spot training every single day. But yeah. That's, I don't know if you guys had any thoughts on that, but I was like, okay, just me playing devil's advocate and trying to break down my argument somewhere.
Yeah, I think the main thing is if someone comes to you telling you they've got a session that increases FTP, you would send them to this discussion or asking, like, the most common thing for a question from an athlete, I think, or desire, if there's no race objective, it's let's just try and get my FTP up. And I think, yeah, if you are getting questions on why is this here, why isn't this here, that kind of thing, then you sort of have to go through all the steps that you've gone through there to come to the conclusion in that there is no one session. It's a combination.
Yeah, yeah. And that's all I have. And I get to the end of this and I'm like, thank you for anyone that's still listening. it's one of those things where, because it's so common and I think people just jump onto it, I think it's important to start addressing these type of arguments. And this is my first time I've kind of laid it out like this. And thanks for you guys for your feedback and your input on this. So it was important to me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. So with that said, thanks for all the people in the audience to stop by today. Hopefully catch up with you next week.
Cool. Thank you.